We talked about the manuscripts of the Bible, and I talked specifically about the great Isaiah scroll. You guys remember that? This is a picture of it, entirely rolled out. That's the entire book of Isaiah. This photograph is online. It's available online. I actually downloaded it, but it's a very large photograph. You're seeing it shrunk down. You can actually zoom in. You can actually read this copy of Isaiah that was made in approximately 300 BC from the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's how old that is. That thing is 300 years. That scroll itself was written, handwritten, 300 years before Christ was born. Is that amazing? Actually, they built a museum in Jerusalem for this scroll. And they have this big kind of giant platform. It's a round building, but right in the middle of the platform, you go up to this big platform, and then there's this big round glass enclosure that's made to look like the end of a scroll. So it's got like the handle sticking up. And they got this entire scroll of Isaiah rolled out so you can walk all the way around it. And if you could read Hebrew, you can actually read a 2,300-year-old scroll of Isaiah the prophet. Isn't that amazing? That copy was made only roughly about 500 years after Isaiah wrote the original, probably a little less than 500 years after Isaiah wrote the original. That's how close it is. And when we compare, zoom in some more on that, if you would. I mean, you could go down and look at every little individual letter if you want online. They have that high resolution of a photograph so that you can compare that. If you read Hebrew, you could compare that to our modern Bible of Isaiah, and you will see that there is really no significant differences between that scroll that's 2,300 years old and the modern copies that we have of Isaiah. Slight spelling differences, things like that, but there's no real differences in meaning in any of the passages, and that's the entire book of Isaiah. You could actually scroll through that. If you could read that, you could find Isaiah 53 and read about the prophecies of Christ's crucifixion in Isaiah 53. It's all in that scroll, that copy made 300 years before he was even born.
That's
very slight. Nothing of any significance. In fact, Isaiah, the Septuagint of Isaiah is very, very, very close to the Hebrew. So yeah, there's not really any significant differences there. What does this prove to us? I mean, we're trying to approach the evidence for God, for His Word, the reliability of the Bible, things like that. We're trying to approach it from sort of a skeptic's point of view. Or I shouldn't say a skeptic's point of view, because a skeptic's point of view might be, well, I'm not going to believe it no matter what you show me, right? But from the point of view of someone who really wants to know, a real truth seeker who really wants to evaluate the evidence and make a decision for himself, am I going to follow this God or not? If he's really a truth seeker, he's going to evaluate the evidence, and this is one of the strongest pieces of evidence that we have that, number one, that the Bible has not been corrupted over the many, many years of copying, at least not enough to change the message at all. And on top of that, that the Bible is supernatural. It's supernatural because of its predictive prophecy. The fact that Christ's crucifixion can be written about in detail 300 years before Christ is even born, and we have absolute proof that it was written that much earlier, shows us that the Bible is in fact supernatural in nature. When Jesus was here, he not here in Tampa, but I mean here on earth, the people said to him, you know, show us a miracle and then we'll believe on you. He did all these miracles, but yet they heard about his miracles and they heard eyewitness testimony of his miracles, and they might have been able to interview somebody who says, yeah, I was born blind, but now I can see. They wanted to see it happen. They wouldn't even believe eyewitness testimony, even though there was plentiful eyewitness testimony. They wouldn't believe it. And so they come to Jesus and say, look, give me a sign right now, you know, do some magic thing in front of me so that I'll believe on you. Well, that kind of person's not going to believe anyway, because there's something wrong with their heart. If they won't even believe the eyewitness testimonies that were plentiful, they're not going to believe even if Jesus performed a magic trick in front of them. Yes.
That's so true. I was once talking to an atheist at USF, and he's like a very aggressive atheist. They try to disprove God. And, I was talking about prayer with him. He used to be a pastor. Like, you know, that pastor about, you know, if you pray and I believe a mountain would be a root to go into the ocean. He's like, I never seen that happen before.
Yeah.
You know, he said, so I was like, well, have you ever prayed in faith or something? He's like, maybe if I saw you pray for someone now, they were healed right here on the spot, I might believe.
Yeah, so, might. But even then, he's hedging.
I thought, okay, maybe I should have much time to pray for something. But I was like, that was kind of a trap. I was like, well, are you sure? Would you really believe if someone was healed right now? Are you sure? And he kind of paused and, like, mm-hmm. I could tell he was like.
He's hedging.
Yeah, he was thinking. He wasn't sure. Like, it was a matter of, like, the heart.
Those who don't want to believe are going to keep setting the bar higher and higher and higher. And if you meet that bar, then they're going to say, oh, no, it's got to be higher. Oh, no, it's got to be higher. And the problem, it's just exactly what Jesus said. The problem is not that there's a lack of evidence. The problem is men love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. If they accept the idea of God and that his word is accurate, they have a big problem. They have a big problem because this Bible says they're condemned because of their lifestyle. And they're not willing to change their lifestyle. So then, what do? They bury their head in the sand. This is exactly what they're doing. They're burying their head in the sand so that they can continue to live the way they want to live. That's that's what it all boils down to. Anyway, that scroll is a miracle. Now you say, well, that's not a miracle, that scroll. It is a miracle. What's a miracle about that scroll is not the fact that it has been preserved and has survived for 2,300 years. That's not really a miracle, not in the literal sense of the word. I mean, it's significant, and of course, no doubt God was involved in making sure that happened. But it's not supernatural in and of itself. But what is supernatural is the prophecies of Christ that are in that scroll. That is supernatural. See, the miracles that Jesus did, the miracles that we have recorded, like the parting of the Red Sea, miracles by their nature are only proof to those who see them, right? They're only proof to those who see them. Now, yes, there is eyewitness testimony. Eyewitness testimony is not absolute proof, but it is substantial evidence that people ought to consider. But the fact that predictive prophecy, and we have the actual copies that show that this prophecy was indeed predicted long before Christ lived about him and about his life and about what he would do. Because we have that is what I would call a literary miracle for us. Because predictive prophecy is of this magnitude is impossible for humans. Isn't that right? We're going to see that we're going to actually go over several predictive prophecies to prove this point probably next week. But there are some very specific prophecies in the Bible written hundreds of years before the events took place where people are called by name and said what they're going to do. And when we have this kind of evidence showing that these things were actually written so far before the events occurred, that's a miracle. Mankind cannot predict the future. That is supernatural. We can't predict the future even to the very dates. Even dates are given. 500 years in the future are given in some of the prophecies. Yeah, I think Kathy had her hand up first. Go ahead.
I was just asking, Isaiah, does that too have prophecy like Nebuchadnezzar and everything that came to pass that was written? Was that written before and then that came to pass?
Yes. The invasion of Nebuchadnezzar yes. In fact, Isaiah contains some pretty specific. It doesn't mention Nebuchadnezzar by name, but it talks about the Babylonians coming and the invasion of the Babylonians. Yeah, that's a major theme in Isaiah. And now that's about Isaiah wrote about 800 BC, and that stuff took place around 600 something BC. So we're talking about a couple of hundred years before the events occurred. Isaiah wrote about them. So yes.
I mean, scholars have to say, like, when they see, like, prophecies of, like, Nebuchadnezzar or kings, yeah, they automatically assume that the book must have been written
after.
After those events happened in the Bible. That's like when I took a class in Hebrew Testament, that's what our teacher said. Like,
they always do that. Yeah. They always do. They do that with Daniel, because Daniel has some very, very specific prophecies about the events that transpired, what we would call in that intertestamental time with Antiochus Epiphanes and all that stuff that went on with the Syrians. Daniel's got some very, very specific things that happened exactly as he said. I mean, very specific things. And, you know, so they'll say, oh, well, Daniel was written after the fact. But the thing, what happens is that the Dead Sea Scrolls, they have completely demolished those arguments. They have completely demolished it. Anybody who will fairly examine the Dead Sea Scrolls can no longer make that argument, oh, that these books are written after the events take place. They can't do it anymore, because we have copies that predate not all of the events, but a lot of the events and a lot of the significant events.
Is Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yes. Wow. There's fragments of it, not all of it, but parts of it. But it shows that the book is that old. Mm-hmm. See? And the fragments that we have, because, you know, when they unroll the scroll, a lot of it falls apart and turns to powder. But the parts of it that they can actually preserve and translate, when they look at that and they see that, you know, there's gaps in it and spaces in it because some of it's powder. But they can compare it to the modern versions of Daniel, and they're the same. So you can extrapolate from that the whole book is the same. And the book predates the events. The copy predates the events. So therefore, you know, the conclusion ought to be that it was written before the events, and therefore it is supernatural. There's lots of miracles recorded in the Bible. And a lot of them were eyewitness accounts of the miracles, particularly the miracles of Christ. I mean, we've got the apostles who actually claimed to be eyewitnesses writing what they saw. They're writing all that down, so we have their testimony. But as I said, miracles are only evidence or proof, I should say, to those who witness them. But by God writing down history in advance, hundreds of years before it takes place, God did the one thing that he could do, that was possible to do, to prove to us many years in the future that these things are true. He validated his word by giving us history in advance, and then giving us plenty of archaeological evidence and finding these old manuscripts and things like that that prove that they were actually written in advance. That is, in fact, a miracle in and of itself. And in my opinion, that argument completely demolishes the whole humanistic mindset. Evolutionists, humanists, those who reject God, are what we call naturalists, which means they do not believe in the supernatural. If you believe in the supernatural, then that automatically leads to some kind of a God. But they don't believe, they think everything happens just because of random chance and by natural causes. What this shows is that no, it doesn't. And therefore, the whole premise of their entire worldview is demolished. Yes?
Yeah, these people will go to the grocery store and buy the National Enquirer that shows Nostradamus' predictions for 2013.
Yeah. Yeah, which have been shown to be bogus anyway. But, yeah. See, Satan also tries to mimic prophecy, doesn't he? He tries to mimic it by giving, you know, I mean, if you throw enough stuff against the wall, you're bound to hit something right. And he does that to try to discredit what God does. But when you look at that kind of stuff, like Nostradamus, supposedly a prophet, if you look at his predictions, they are so vague. They don't give any dates or times or anything like that. They just kind of give vague things. I mean, if you look throughout all human history, you can find something that sounds sort of like what Nostradamus said, right? So then people, oh, Nostradamus was a prophet. Nah, rubbish. No, that's not the kind of stuff you see in the Bible. What you see in the Bible is talking about, for example, in Daniel 9, talking about the Messiah coming, and the Messiah will be cut off. And he says how many years is going to be from the time that the Babylonian captivity ends until the coming of, until the Messiah is cut off. He gives the number of years there. It's actually 493 years. He gives that period of time. And if you do all the math to work out the chronology, that's exactly when Christ was crucified. How can somebody say that the Messiah is going to come and be crucified on this date, 500 years in the future, and it actually happened? How can they do that? That's not normal. That's not, you can't do that with a humanistic worldview. It doesn't fit into a humanistic worldview. There's something supernatural going on. There's somebody that's greater than man in control of not only what was written down, but who is guiding history and making these events unfold. See, somebody writing 500 years ago couldn't actually make that happen 500 years in the future because he doesn't live that long. Right? Somebody else's hand I thought I saw go up. Maybe not.
I was going to point back to what you're saying about how it is proof for only those who observe the miracle. I think that's one of the reasons why Christ said to, I believe it was Thomas, you have seen and believed, yet blessed are those who believe yet have not seen.
Have not seen and yet have believed. But when he said that, he doesn't mean somebody's just supposed to believe on blind faith. Because the New Testament tells us that our faith is not based on just, some fairy tale. Our faith is based on documented evidence from eyewitnesses. That's the key. Documented evidence from eyewitnesses. We're gonna look at some of that in a minute. But let me go on here. We have the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's probably the most impressive piece right there because it's the entire book of Isaiah, all 66 chapters preserved. The scroll is 2,300 years old. In the New Testament, you might ask, well, what is the manuscript evidence for the New Testament? Because the Dead Sea Scrolls only concerned the Old Testament. They were Jews who hid this stuff away. They didn't believe, they weren't Christians, so the New Testament documents are not preserved in any of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But what do we have as far as the New Testament is concerned? Well, there are several collections of ancient manuscripts. Some of them are very fragmentary, but some of them are complete books. One of the best collections of the oldest manuscript is called the Bodmer Papyri, and that is a collection of old manuscripts that were found at once and sold to a guy named Bodmer, so that's why it's called the Bodmer Papyri. It contains several sections of the New Testament. One of the papyrus books that's included in that is called P66. That's just a scholarly way of numbering it so they know what we're talking about. It has most of the Gospel of John. And when I say most, it's not because it wasn't complete. It's that some of it has, crumbled and fallen off. But it contains most of the Gospel of John, and it's dated by scholars to about AD 200. Now, AD 200 is only 100 years after John died. And it's a copy of the Gospel of John. That's pretty impressive. That's taking it all the way back to within 100 years. I mean, here we are 2,000 years later, and it's taken the Gospel of John back to within 100 years of the life of John. What does that show us? Well, first of all, again, when we compare the manuscripts, we see that what we have now is what was written then. Okay, that's one. Secondly, for many years, unbelieving scholars have said, the writers, the apostles didn't actually write any of this. This stuff was written by Christians centuries later, pretending to be the apostles. I mean, that was what was written all the time. But what this shows is we've got it down within 100 years of John's own life on that particular manuscript. There's another manuscript called P52, which is a small section of the Gospel of John. It's what would they call a fragment. It's from John chapter 18. On the front side, it has verses 31 through 33, and on the back side, it has verses 37 through 38. So you can tell it was part of a leaf. By that time, by the way, they were using books in leaves like we have now as opposed to scrolls. By the time that the New Testament was written, that was becoming popular, and they were binding books as well by that time. So this was that type of a book. This fragment, even though it's fairly small, is dated to AD 117 to 138, which is only 20 to 40 years after John's death. I mean, his kid could have wrote it, copied it. We're talking really, really close to the time that John wrote it. Once these manuscripts were discovered, the whole idea that the Gospels were written, in the second or third century, that whole idea has been completely demolished. by these discoveries of these ancient scrolls. Okay, again, they date the scrolls by the material they're written on and by the type of script that is being used, because script, the way people write, has changed over time. All right, so they have so much other material that, not biblical, other, you know, secular material that has been dated, they can compare these things and decide how old this particular fragment is, and then that's essentially proof of its age. Yeah, that's we talked about that before, but that's the early church fathers. That is those who were the early Christians after the apostles, wrote a lot of material that quotes the Bible. They'll be talking about something. It's sort of like a sermon, you know, where I'll be preaching and then I'll quote a verse or scripture of the Bible. You'll find that in their writings all the time where they quote. You can actually take from that source alone, you can reconstruct most of the New Testament just from their quotations, and a lot of the Old Testament as well, just from that alone. So what we've shown is that, what we've proven, let me put it this way, what we've proven is that the Bible we have today is reliable in the sense that in its transmission history, that is, in its history of being hand copied over and over and over and over again, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, that when we look at the end result and we compare it to these ancient, very ancient pieces of the Bible that we find right down to within just a few decades of the author's life, when we compare them, we see that what we have now is what they actually wrote. All right, so the Bible has not been corrupted from the time of the apostles or the time that the authors wrote them until now. I mean, that whole claim, which is one of the main claims that the Muslims use against Christianity, that whole claim has been demolished. Yes?
In terms of like internal evidence, there's a guy named John A.T. Robinson who argued that the entire New Testament was written prior to 70 A.D. because nothing in the New Testament signifies the structure of the temple and what happened to it at that point. Like, Jesus has some kind of prediction, but like when the apostles are talking about Jewish customs and life, it all sounds like as if things are going on as normal.
You see that?
Yeah.
Actually, there is some circumstantial evidence that Jude and Revelation were probably written, and probably John's epistles were written after the destruction of the temple. But most of the books are written in such a way that it seems apparent that the temple was still in operation, especially Hebrews. Hebrews talks about what the priests were actually doing at the temple right then. This is what they do. It uses the present tense talking about what the priests are doing at the temple when it's talking about offering sacrifices and stuff like that. So the perspective of the writer was clearly before the temple was destroyed in AD 70. You know, I want to look at a couple of verses of scripture. Take your Bible and go to John chapter 19, please. What we haven't shown yet, we haven't a little bit, but what we really haven't absolutely proven, probably beyond a shadow of a doubt, is that the original writers, when they wrote the originals, wrote by inspiration of God. That is, everything they wrote is absolutely accurate. We haven't actually proven that yet, but what we have proven is that our Bibles today are accurate representations of what they wrote, and we have also proven that interwoven into the biblical documents are definitely miraculous things, okay? Miraculous in the sense that the writing of it is miraculous because it predated the events by such significant periods of time, okay? We haven't proven that the Bible is error-free yet, but we're leading there, right? We're trying to close all the loopholes in the arguments against it is what we're trying to do. All right, look at John chapter 19, verse 35. Now, this is John writing his gospel. He says, and he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth so that you may believe. Now, what is John saying here? What is he saying? He's saying, I'm not just writing down stuff I heard. He's saying, I am giving you an account of what I saw. That's what he's saying. The one who's seen it has written it down. So, and he's written it down so that you might believe. In other words, I'm giving you a written eyewitness testimony. That's what he's saying. Would that hold up in court?
Definitely.
Yes, that would hold up in court. It definitely would hold up in court. Go to chapter 21 of John, verse 24. He's talking about himself. This is the disciple who testifies of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. John is saying, not only did I see these things, I wrote this book. I'm an eyewitness, and I wrote this account of what Jesus said and did. And he lived with him. John lived with Jesus for 3.5 years. Now, go to 1 John, which is towards the back of the Bible. John makes it this point even stronger in his epistle of 1 John. It's the same writer. The very first thing he says in his book, look at what he says. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and our hands have handled concerning the word of life. And the word there, as you'll see, it's capitalized. And it's because John, throughout his writings, refers to Jesus as the word, right? The word became flesh and dwelt among us and all that in John chapter 1, verse 14, right? That's a proper name. That's why it's capitalized there. So he's saying it's a reference to Jesus. What's he saying? We, plural, we have seen, we have heard, and we have actually touched him. We have handled him. The life was manifested and we have seen and bear witness. What's he saying? We're eyewitnesses. We, the apostles. The we there is the apostles. And declare to you that eternal life which was with the Father and was manifested to us. That is Christ. This is a passage that shows the pre-existence of Christ. Some people teach, oh, Jesus didn't pre-exist. He just was a man. No, he was not just a man. He was God, and he became a man, as we'll see in Philippians as we go through that. All right, in order to do something, that is to die on our behalf. But he was with the Father, and then he was manifested to us. That which we have seen and heard, we declare to you, that you may also have fellowship with us. And truly our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. See, what he's saying, he's talking about the fact that the apostles are not just telling a story that they heard or that they made up. The apostles are eyewitnesses of the account, the actual events that took place. And they wrote these books as the ones who actually saw the events take place. That's the point that he's making. Go to 1 Peter chapter 5. Back up a couple of pages. Peter says the same thing. In 1 Peter 5, verse 1, the elders who are among you, I exhort, I who am a fellow elder, and notice this, and a witness of the sufferings of Christ. Peter also is saying, I'm not writing secondhand information. I'm writing firsthand information. I write what I saw. And of course, all the New Testament writers, the apostles that is, were eyewitnesses of Christ and his ministry, with the exception of Paul, because Paul became a Christian after the fact. Now, Paul wrote Hebrews. Is Paul honest about the fact that he was not an eyewitness of these things? He is. Go to Hebrews chapter 2. Paul says his testimony is secondhand. Look at Hebrews chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, we must give the more earnest heed to the things we have heard, lest we drift away. For if the word spoken through angels proved steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation? Now notice this, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord, that he's talking about Christ's own preaching and teaching, and was confirmed to us by those, third person plural, who heard him. Notice that. It was confirmed to us. Paul uses first person there, us, meaning me and others. What Jesus said and did and preached has been confirmed to us by eyewitnesses. By that statement, he shows I'm not an eyewitness, number one, to those things. I'm relying on the testimony of the firsthand eyewitnesses, which is the other 11 apostles. See, so what we have here is complete honesty. Total and complete honesty by the Apostle Paul, and complete honesty by the other writers as well. Those who claimed firsthand knowledge did indeed have firsthand knowledge. Those who claimed secondhand knowledge did indeed have secondhand knowledge, and they're not trying to pass off their knowledge as being firsthand knowledge. Right? What that shows is, if we were cross-examining these witnesses, it shows that these witnesses have credibility. They have credibility, and therefore their testimony ought to be believed. See, if we put all the evidence that we're talking about in a courtroom situation with an unbiased jury, there is absolutely no question how it would come out in the end. Is the Bible the inspired word of God? Yes, absolutely. There's no question about it. It'd be a unanimous decision. Now, if we put in the jury people who didn't want to believe, it's going to come out differently. That's just how faith works. Faith is not just believe, like I said, it's not blind faith. It's not just believing a fairy tale. God gives us evidence that if it is fairly evaluated, it may not be 100% proof, but it is so weighty that if we approach it in a fair and an unbiased way, it will absolutely lead us to conclude that God is true and his word is true. But the question is, are we going to approach it from that perspective? Are we going to look at it because we want to know the truth and we're going to pursue the truth? Or are we going to look at it because we want to explain it away because we don't like what it says? Let's look at some external evidence. You can say, well, you know, the apostles, they wrote the New Testament. How do we know they didn't all collude together and make up this story about Jesus and his crucifixion and his resurrection and all that kind of stuff? Did Jesus even really live? How do we know this isn't just a fairy tale that's only in those books in the Bible? Well, it's because there's plenty of external evidence that Jesus lived and died and did the things that we see in the Gospels, and that this big following of Christians, you know, that the apostles went out and preached the gospel and many people were converted and all that you read in the Gospels and in Acts, that this actually happened, because there are non-Christian writers from the period who mention Christ, mention the Christians, and mention certain events that are recorded in the Bible about Jesus. For example, there is a writer called Mara ben Serapion. He wrote a letter to his son, and this letter has been dated to about AD 73, which is well within the lifetime of John. He wrote a letter to his son, and in this letter, he describes the death of Christ. And the guy is not a Christian. There's not evidence in the letter that he was actually a Christian. He's just talking about something that happened back there in Judea, the death of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ. Other first and second century sources that mention Jesus Christ, including the Roman historian Cornelius Tacitus and Suetonius. These are Roman historians, pagans, who mention Christ or mention the apostles or mention the early Christians at that time, writing about the events in the time of Christ and his ministry. Then there is a Roman governor called Pliny the Younger. This Roman governor was writing to a higher official in order to find out how he was to deal with these Christians and these followers of the Christus, he calls them. It's sort of a Latinized, everything in Roman names end with U.S., right? It's sort of like a Romanized version of it. And he talks about these followers of this Christus and what was going on with them. So he's as a governor of a city, you know, governing all these pagans, he's talking about these Christians and the followers of this Christ. Back then, at that time. Then there is a Greek satirist, one who mocked other people, and he wrote satires against Christ and Christians. So he certainly wasn't a Christian. He was mocking Christ and Christians, writing back then as well. And then, of course, we have the Jewish Talmud. That is ancient Jewish writings from around this period, shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem and so forth. They talk about Christ and they disparage him. So if he didn't really live and didn't really exist and didn't really die and all these things that are mentioned in the Bible, how come all these other people who are not Christians know about him, writing back then in these ancient times. The Bible gives many, 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 many historical details about what was going on during something that's written about in the Bible. For example, Luke, when he talks about the birth of Christ, you know what? Let's look at it. Luke chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. This is only one of a multitude of examples. Luke 2, verses 1 and 2. It came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This census first took place while Quirinius was governing Syria. So all went out to be registered, everyone to his own city. Now, what he's giving us is who the emperor was and who the local ruler was. He's telling us these things. Now, you read that in the Bible. Well, those things can be verified. They can be verified through Roman historical writings. You can go back and read some of the writings of these men when they were rulers or emperors or whatever. And whole histories of the Roman Empire have been constructed where all this, you know, they've got lots and tons of documents where they have put everything together and they have figured out a timeline of who was doing what when, who was ruling here, who was ruling there, who was a local ruler when this guy was the emperor. All that kind of stuff has all been worked out through much archaeological work. And so when you look at the Bible, and he's telling us these kinds of details, you can go back and check the historical record and see if this is, in fact, what was going on at the time. And indeed it is. That's one of the amazing things about the Bible is that archaeology, you know what archaeology is, right? They dig up the remains of ancient civilizations and whatnot. Archaeology has actually been driven and depended on the Bible for centuries. That is, when they are trying to discover some civilization that lived so many years ago and there's nothing that remains of it today and they don't know where to look for it or dig or whatnot, they use the Bible. They use the Bible. It talks about places and people groups and what they did and what they were like, and they use the Bible and they end up discovering the remains of that particular civilization, right where the Bible said it was, and that sort of thing. They've used the Bible, archaeologists have used the Bible as their guide for discovering ancient history for centuries. And it has proven itself to be right over and over and over and over and over and over again. Now, lots of times they would come and say, oh, well, the Bible talks about this group and we've never found any evidence of them. The Bible's wrong. This has happened repeatedly. The Hittites is one example of that. They said the Bible talks about the Hittites. There never was any such people called the Hittites. And scholars said that for years. There never were any Hittites until one day they found the Hittites. They found the remains of the Hittite Empire. And it's right where it was supposed to be. See, what happens is the Bible ends up being right. They keep making accusations against the Bible. And then years later, the Bible proves itself to be right again by more modern discoveries. So, what does that show? Well, that doesn't itself show that it's supernatural, but what it does show is that the people who wrote those histories had access, and they actually lived back in those days, and they recorded an accurate history. If their histories are accurate, why should we not believe when they said the word of the Lord appeared to Isaiah the prophet and said? See, what we're doing is we have established by these means, we have established the credibility of the writers. And if the writers are credible in what they say, then we should believe them when they tell us supernatural things took place. The flood, that was pretty amazing, right? There's plenty of physical evidence of the flood. I mean, you can go to the Grand Canyon and look at that. And when they tell you how the Grand Canyon formed from the guides, you can kind of laugh and chuckle because it's ridiculous, it's preposterous. The Grand Canyon formed because of the flood, and a bunch of water got trapped farther up. And then after the flood subsided, whatever was holding it back broke loose, and all that just came rushing out. And it carved out that Grand Canyon, and it wasn't carving it out of rock. It was carving it out of many, many layers of mud sediment. It just washed it right out. And then later that all hardened into rock. That's how it happened. But of course, they have to come up with a theory that agrees with evolution, that it took billions of years for everything to happen. But the point is, there's plenty of evidence. If anybody approaches this from the perspective of being completely objective and honest, there's only one conclusion they can come to. God has given so much evidence that his word is true, that he is real, that it's really, you have to just put your hand over your eyes and say, I won't believe it. I won't believe it. And that's what most of the world does. They're the fools. Because the Bible tells us how to have immortality, how to have eternal life, how to live forever, as opposed to the rest of the world that's headed for destruction. And the choice is yours, which one you're going to believe and which one you're going to follow. Yes?
How does the Book of Mormon and the Quran stack up to this evidence we have in the Bible?
The Book of Mormon is laughable. The Book of Mormon tells about supposedly Jesus came to America and preached to the Indians, but there has never been a shred of archaeological or any other kind of historical evidence that validates any of that history that's in the Book of Mormon. Nothing. As opposed to the Bible, we've got tons of it. All over the world, we've got it. There's no question about it. The Quran is not really a history book, so it's not validating history or anything like that. The Quran is more of sayings, if you've ever read it. Of the Quran? I don't know a whole lot about it, but it has issues as far as, you know, copying and so forth. As any hand-copied book is going to have, mistakes hand-copied in it. But the thing about the Bible is there are so many manuscripts that when people did make mistakes hand-copying it, you can weed out the mistakes by comparing a vast number of manuscripts and find out, oh, well, this reading only appears in, you know, three or four manuscripts and the vast majority don't have that reading, then probably that's the error, right? And so there are other ways of weeding it out as well. But anyway, that's another story. Anyway, the evidence is overwhelming. Now, what we want to talk about next week is the inspiration of the scriptures. That is what the Bible says about itself. We've already shown that these are trustworthy men who wrote it, and we have shown that what they wrote is the same thing as what we have in our Bibles today. So we're going to talk a little bit about the inspiration of the scriptures and that next week.